Real people. Real opinions. Real talk radio. The multi-award-winning Niall Boylan Show. Classic hits.
Today, I want to speak about the mental health services in Ireland. And we mentioned this at the start of the show. And it comes after I read a startling report today that stated that Ireland's spend on mental health is 5% of our overall health budget, while the World Health Organization recommends a mental health budget of 12% of the overall health budget. Now, this news comes after the back in September, or last September, it was reported that 10 million, which had been allocated for better mental health services during COVID, remained unspent. So what's wrong? Advocates say it comes as Ireland's mental health supports are seriously underfunded. And as the country went into lockdown at the start of last year, demand for mental health services soared, obviously, because people obviously were in isolation and people were facing up to realities and relationships were breaking down and all that. Look, there were so many different things that affected people's mental health throughout the year. And to cope, in February, the government announced 10 million would be allocated to mental health supports. COVID continues to wreak havoc on our mental health services, as nearly 600 mental health nurses are off sick because of COVID-19, the Psychiatric Nurses Association has said. And the association warned that the current situation is unsustainable and says members have complained that their workplaces are no longer safe. So today I want to ask you about your experiences and what your experiences have been in getting support through mental health services here in Ireland for yourself or for a loved one, for a mother, father, brother, sister or for a child. What has your experience been and how long were you waiting to get those services? Do you feel the service was adequate or do you feel you were completely ignored, as some people said in the past? Or I've had parents on said they're trying to get mental health services for their children and they're waiting 18 months just to get onto CAMHS or something like that. So let me know what your experience has been and what can we do about it. But in the interim, and by the way, if you want to text us, you can, or text us your story at 087-188-0008. You can WhatsApp or text or send us a voicemail if you want to on WhatsApp too. I want to speak to Fiona Coyle, who's the CEO of Mental Health Reform. Good afternoon to Fiona.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Fiona, firstly, I'm quite shocked at this 5% of the overall health budget. But in saying that, when I read the story about the 10 million that was allocated that wasn't spent, sure, it doesn't matter how much we throw at it if we've nowhere to spend it or we don't have the, I suppose, the administration and the people to actually utilise it.
Yeah, like the Mental Health Reforms, we're the National Coalition for Mental Health. So we represent 77 organisations coming mainly from the community and voluntary sector. And, you know, we've been campaigning for the last decade in terms of increasing funding and spending in mental health. Like we're far behind where we need to be. Like Sláinte Care, the government's own plan, puts a target of 10% on mental health as a percentage of overall health spending. You know, high quality services do need, you know, high levels of investment. You know, there's no getting around that.
Yeah. When you say it's you recommend 10% of the overall spend on health, so the overall spend on health is about 16 billion a year. So are you suggesting then, I suppose, we should be spending 10% of that? And what currently is the spend on mental health in this country? Or do you know what the spend is?
Yeah, so last year, the most up-to-date figures that we had, now things changes, you know, over the course of the year, it was, you know, just over 5%. So it's significantly behind where it needs to be. And, you know, when you look at other countries like the UK spent 13% of their healthcare budget, which, you know, they have a significant healthcare budget as well. So it does need, you know, investment and money is really important. But I think you made the point as well, you know, it can't be investment alone. Like you can make all the commitments that in the world, but unless that money is being prioritised and being spent,
So it's all well and good, you know, having a few billion, for example, if that's what we want to spend on mental health, and that's what we should spend, by the way, on mental health, because let's be clear, mental health is equally as important as physical health. But if we have the money, how are we going to spend it if we don't have the people to utilise it? And we currently don't, do we, Fiona?
Yeah, no, it's a really valid point. And, you know, our mental health services are run by individuals. You know, that's what the service is based on. And there are brilliant individuals across the country who are working so hard. There just isn't enough of them. And I think this is not only a challenge for the mental health sector, but for the health sector in general. And, you know, it's something that needs to be prioritised and addressed. And that's where the leadership question comes into it. So one of the things that we've been kind of campaigning for in terms of mental health is that there's currently no kind of, I suppose, director of mental health within the HSE. So someone who would report directly into the CEO, Paul Reid, like that's something that was there.
Would that make a difference to have somebody who is over everything, so to speak? In other words, somebody who is delegating everything and obviously delegating that budget that you would have, which I'm trying to work it out, is roughly at the moment, currently it's only for, you're saying you would, oh, you'd like to see 10%. 5% at the moment currently of 16 billion is 8. Is that 8? 800 million?
Yeah, okay,
but you want to see double that at least, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so somebody has to be there to delegate that money and say, okay, I want to put some of this into CAMHS, I want to put some of this into mental health services for adults, I want to put some of this into Jigsaw, I want to put some of this into whatever it is. So currently we've no, is there nobody doing that?
We have a great, you know, there's great staff within the HSE who at operational level are doing that. Like they're taking the budget, but what you have is there's strategic issues there, like staffing being one of them. But there, you know, other issues as well that require, you know, that require leadership, that require maybe the input of Paul Reid, require the input of the minister and the department. And, you know, the team who's there is, you know, when you focus so much on operation, it needs that senior level of buy-in.
If we have the money, and clearly we have some money because there was 10 million left over last year, but I mean, clearly there should be a lot more spent. The WHO has recommended 12%, which is 2% above what you're even recommending. Why can't we hire people, even if it means hire people from abroad? Because if we had a decent budget, because we can see how important it is to people.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I am reading story after story after story of people who've been failed. And I'm not suggesting, by the way, it's anything to do with you, Fiona, as the CEO of Mental Health Reform or anything else, or the people working on the front line. Clearly, it's not anything to do with them. It's administration, you know, it's delegation. But people who are being failed by services, who can't get their children into services, who may be suicidal or who maybe have learning difficulties or whatever it happens to be, or have mental health problems, who can't get their children into any services whatsoever. It's just,
yeah, no, it's shocking. It's a huge issue. It's really, and I think that's where our members, so, you know, you mentioned some of them like Jigsaw, Grow Ireland, like a lot of our members would be providing really key services to the public and kind of, and, you know, a lot of those organisations as well would receive funding from the HSE to deliver those services. But, you know, something we campaigned for last year, which didn't come to fruition, was that, you know, our members are seeing a significant rise in the amount of people who are looking for support, and yet their funding doesn't go up. You know, they're, for us, you know, it makes sense that, you know, to further support the community and voluntary sector, you know, that's one way where support could be impactfully given. You know,
absolutely.
And the
other shocking part of this, I've heard many stories of people saying basically they didn't have health insurance. They faced huge barriers. I mean, what can be done? I mean, you know, if I want to get a child assessed tomorrow, I can go privately, of course, and pay 800 or 900 quid if I want to. But to get a public service or to get a public appointment, I could be waiting 16 months. So how can we get rid of that barrier, the money barrier for people? Because everybody should be treated equally when it comes to mental health. So how do we get rid of that barrier?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, it's back to kind of staffing, like our community mental health teams across the country. Even before COVID, there many of them were at 60-70% capacity. And, you know, you mentioned now, like all of our health service, the impact that COVID is having. So unless you have people there to see individuals, you know, the lists are going to be long. And, you know, I don't think it's acceptable. Like what we've been hearing from GPs is that, you know, they're assessing people who come in and they say to them, look, I can put you on a list, but, you know, do you think you're able to afford the couple of hundred euro to go private? You know, that would be my advice to you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that there's so many people, especially in the current climate, just can't afford that.
Well, you say a couple of hundred, I remember many years ago, my own daughter, I had to bring her for services and I had to bring her to see a child psychiatrist. And I think it was like three visits. I think it was like 700-800 quid. You know, and if I didn't do that, I would have been waiting, you know, a year to see somebody.
Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, the lists are getting longer, and the services aren't there. And, you know, and that's why we need to kind of like the investment is one thing, but there are a lot of services, you know, like last year there was like kind of 38.8 million announced in budget, which, you know, we welcomed, and then there was an additional 10 million, which we understand now, you know, is being spent, and the minister made an announcement before Christmas. So, but there are a lot of areas, you know, for example, we have really brilliant national clinical programs. Like, so we have a program on eating disorders or early intervention psychosis. These, you know, all actors agree this is a brilliant model of care, and there's a plan there on how to scale up to ensure that those services are available around the country.
But and I think children's services are probably priority. And I say that, and I'm not disregarding adult services, right, but children's services, because if we can prevent, you know, we can get in there early intervention, you know, with young children developing depression from a very young age, which will go on into an adult life. If we can stop that at an early age, we will save a lot of money in the long term in many years to come. And that's the same as we would do normally with physical health. So that's something that we should be prioritising, should have young children.
Yeah, like with the investment case, we try and make it to finance every year, you know, invest now, save later. Like, you know, that's what we've been kind of trying to say to government for years, is that this is not just, you know, an ethical or a moral question of providing services. This is the smart thing to do. You know, you're investing now, and you know the money you have to invest in that individual over their lifespan will be less, because, and their quality of life, their ability to kind of have a meaningful life, engage with society is really clear.
Could we not do, I mean, during the start of COVID, of course, the Minister for Health acquisitioned private hospitals. We paid private hospitals to deal with the public sector because obviously we needed the resources. Currently at the moment, for example, a stay in a mental health service unit, you know, if you have a health insurance, will cost or is charged about 900 quid a day. So those services are available. They do have staff. Why can't we do something similar, and why can't we consider this to be some sort of an emergency? Because clearly it is. I mean, we talk about the pandemic being an emergency. Mental health problems are also a pandemic as well, in a sense, if you know what I mean. Because it can cause huge problems for people. And people die, of course, from mental health problems too. So why can't we acquisition or use some of those private services, and the state pay some of those private services to deal with the backlogs of people, particularly young children who are waiting to see mental health services?
Yeah, well, I suppose that's already ongoing. So the state, the HSE, does engage with some of the kind of the private services. You know, they do pay for public patients to engage with those private services when there is a need. Mm-hmm. But I suppose that it's kind of the system. And especially that would happen at the more acute end, you know, in terms of inpatient stays. Mm-hmm. So that does happen, but, you know, it's the investment in the whole system. So ensuring, like as you say, that someone gets an appointment and gets seen in an appropriate time frame, so that maybe their crisis, they don't get to that crisis point. It is about, you know, it is kind of about that investment at the different stages, and that, yeah, there is, you know, prioritisation given as well.
Because you know as well as I do, with mental health, it usually is something that needs to be seen immediately. I mean, generally speaking, when you're talking about, it's like if somebody's diagnosed with cancer, they have to be dealt with immediately. An oncologist will recommend early intervention. You're straight in for chemotherapy, etc., to prevent it getting worse. So if you have, a 19-year-old or a 20-year-old or a 16-year-old who, you know, has suicide ideations or ideologies, and you want to get them into a mental health service, or you want to get them seen by somebody, you can't be turning around to somebody and saying, oh, well, I think you can fit you in an appointment in 6 months' time. That's no good. They need that service now. It's not in 6 months. And by the way, don't please from 1 minute, don't think I'm criticising you, Fiona, or the mental health reform. But I'm just saying that, how can we fix this and get those appointments now, rather than be referred on for 6 months? I know you don't have a magic wand. I'm aware of that.
Unfortunately, this is, I suppose, where some of the complexities are. It's not an overnight fix. It requires, you know, attention, and it requires kind of, you know, that political leadership from, you know, the Taoiseach and downwards, because it's for so long in this country, you know, if you think about our history, we've come a long way. Like, mm-hmm. you know, we had in the 1960s, a figure that always strikes me is had we had the highest number of people per population in institutions of any other country in the world. So we were kind of really based on this institutional model, and we moved away from that. And, you know, in the early noughties, we launched a really brilliant policy document that was moving towards community services. Then the economic crash happened. So instead of more money being put into community services, there were less than there was ever before. And we're still coming back from that, you know, and that was a huge shock to the system, where we moved away from this institutional model, which was rightly so, because there were people in institutions that shouldn't have been there and could live full and frank, brilliant lives in the community. But, you know, we're still trying to strengthen, you know, our services. And for so long, you know, there was a reluctance, you know, mental health just wasn't spoken about.
That's because we can't see it.
You know, yeah.
It's not like you see people on crutches. It's easy to see physical health, isn't it? You know, we don't see
mental
health.
I think now more and more there's an awareness, but there's a frustration there. You know, there is a frustration there. One thing I did want to mention as well is that it's, you know, in January, there has been a huge amount of discussion around mental health and around suicide. And just to make people aware as well, you know, around some of the support lines that are out there, in terms of, you know, the Samaritans and others, if anyone ever needed to talk, because it can be, you know, quite a triggering conversation as well, talking about these, about mental health. And there may be people out there who are struggling to access services, but, you know, there is support out there that some of our members do provide. And I will
give some of those numbers just at the end of the interview. I will give some of those numbers as well. Well, listen, Fiona, I hope it's onwards and upwards. I hope we can provide a better service in the future. I hope you get the budget that's required, not just the 10% you're looking for, but the 12% recommended by the WHO. I hope the Minister for Health will look into this more deeply, because, of course, we've been a little bit, I'm not going to use the word obsessed with COVID, but, you know, unless it's COVID at the moment, you know, nothing really seems to be happening in this country. So I think we need to be addressing these other issues too, because in the meantime, while COVID is happening, young people and adults are still suffering from depression. They're still suffering. We're still seeing suicide, and unfortunately, out there in society, and we're still seeing people not getting the services they require. And those services should be available to them. We should be able to provide them. Certainly in the future, we should be able to make a better world for everybody. Listen, thank you very much indeed, and I appreciate you coming on the air, Fiona. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye. There you go. Fiona Coyle, CEO of Mental Health Reform. By the way, if you do, or if you are triggered, as Fiona says, by anything that we spoke about in the conversation today, and you do need to call somebody and chat to somebody, or you're looking for some services, you can contact the Samaritans, and you can now call them on 116123, or indeed you can get Pieta House if you want to on 1-800-247-247. That's 1-800-247-247. So if you want to contact any of those. Also want to hear from you too, by the way. What has your experience been? Maybe you've tried to get support or services. Let me know. The number is 087-188-0008. What has your experience been? You know, trying to get an appointment to see a doctor for depression. Anything at all. I mean, has your experience been good, generally speaking? Or were you waiting 18 months just to see somebody? And those numbers again that I gave out earlier on, people that somebody texted and so was the number. Samaritans is 116123, and also you can call Pieta House at 1-800-247. Mary, you're in Ireland's Classic Kids. How are you doing, Mary?
Hi, Niall. How are you?
Now, you were failed by the system.
Yes.
Catastrophically, you were failed by the system. But just tell us the story about your son.
He was the youngest of four boys. From a young age, he kind of acted out a bit. So he was getting counselling, going up through school. And then he hit a certain age where they felt, well, he's old enough now to kind of, you know, go out into the world, and he didn't need any more counselling.
Yeah.
So as he grew through teenage years, he became troubled. And a couple of occasions he attempted suicide. Thank God I was there kind of for each one. The final straw, he had taken an overdose, and we had gone to our nearest hospital, and as soon as he got out of the ambulance, he was talking and everything. He refused help and just started walking home.
Yeah.
This was about 4 o'clock in the morning, so I walked home with him. It was a pretty dark road, and it was about 8 miles. So he promised me the next day that we would talk to a doctor, and the doctor at the time referred him to a psychiatrist. And So he agreed, and we went to see the psychiatrist, and I had a chat with her, and then they spoke to him on his own, and then they called me back in, and they said, well, I don't see that he has any issues. I think he's just, you know, he's 18, he's 17 at the time.
And you had obviously told them about his history of trying to take his own life, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Sorry, what was it, when you were walking down the road with Ben, your son, I mean, what was he saying to you? What was his concerns at that? Sorry, what age would he have been at that stage now?
He would have been 17.
Okay, and so what were his concerns in life at 17 years of age when he was walking down that dark road with you that night? And what was he telling you his concerns were?
He wanted to die.
He wanted to die?
He wanted to walk out in front of a car. And I said, if you do, I'll do it with you. And I think that kind of kept him going.
Yeah.
So we eventually got home.
But did he tell you what? I know, I don't want you to get upset. I'm just wondering, did he tell you why he felt that way?
He just didn't want to be here anymore. Mm-hmm. He was the most popular person.
Yeah.
But he was so lonely when he was on his own. And he couldn't stand that.
Okay.
He had to be kind of around people. And he just hated to be on his own, I think.
And I'm sorry, by the way, this conversation is upsetting you. And I know it is upsetting.
No, it's good to talk about it. So, yeah, when the psychiatrist said to me, oh, I think he's just acting out, he's just a boy, you know. And
gosh,
I said, well, look, you weren't there when I found him behind the shed with the rope. You weren't there when he took the overdose. You weren't there, you know, when I can't think the other, it was three occasions anyway. And she said, look, we review him and we'll send out an appointment. And I just felt she didn't listen.
Yeah.
And the following August, he hung himself and I wasn't there.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I know that's been very difficult for you.
Yeah.
I mean, as a mother, you never expect you're ever going to bury your own son. Ever.
No.
Ever in a million years. Yeah. And particularly when you feel that it's something that may have been preventable. If he had got more help and the help he needed.
I always said, I mean, there's somebody from that system came to speak to me after Ben died and they said, do you want to talk about it or do you want to ask anything? And I said, just that in future, if a mother or father tell you their child is suffering with depression, they're the ones that are seeing it. They're the ones that know.
Believe them.
Please believe them. And I said, if that stops one more parent having to go through what I had to go through.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the mental health system in Ireland is absolutely shocking at the moment as regards funding.
Well, this is what I was trying to say earlier on to our spokesperson earlier on there. I was saying, if we can solve it in young people, I mean, don't get me wrong, adults are important too, of course, absolutely. But I think when it comes to young people, particularly teenagers between the age of 15 and 18 years of age, that seems to be a very vulnerable age. But if we can solve it there and help them, I think we're investing in the future, because I think that will stop them from hopefully help them to deal with mental health problems throughout their lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, but
shortly after Ben died, I got involved in fundraising for a local counselling service. And it's through there that I met a counsellor, because I don't think I would be here today if it wasn't for him.
Mm-hmm.
An absolutely amazing counsellor. I'm blessed. But I applied for funding from the lottery on behalf of this place, because we don't have government funding. And they kind of basically said, oh, you wouldn't be entitled to it because nobody applied before. I'm like, how do you get it if you don't apply to begin with?
Yeah.
But these are like counselling for young people or old people, or, you know, they welcome anybody that needs help and that needs to talk to counsellor. My sister actually counsels for free down there.
That's dreadful that you can't get funding for it, and it's a basic service.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's a basic service.
And this is
really
the problem.
Need.
This is what I said earlier on. If you have cancer, and you know you're diagnosed as stage 4 cancer or something like that, you'll get seen to immediately by an oncologist. You'll get your chemotherapy, whatever it is, and rightly so, by the way, to obviously prevent it getting worse or to try and save your life. But if you have a mental health problem which is causing you great distress, where you might have suicide ideation, you know, you could be, a parent could bring a child, you know, to a doctor, get a recommendation or a referral. You know, to go to a psychiatrist, psychologist, you could be waiting 6 months to get an appointment.
Absolutely.
And it's life or it's literally life or death.
Yeah. It's like if they can't see it, they don't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
I think for most people to understand depression, you probably have to have been there at some stage or
I know.
Seen
I know.
Somebody with it.
Yeah.
You know?
And I'm sorry he was in such a dark place. And it sounds like you had such a wonderful relationship with him as well, that he did talk to you. He did talk to you.
Absolutely,
But he just felt there was no light at the end of the tunnel at that point, sadly, in his life.
Yeah. We had our arguments. I mean, what mother and son don't?
Well, do you know what? They're part of the memories that you'll always have too. You know, the arguments and some of the silly arguments you might have had with him as well. What sort of guy was Ben, by the way? Was he
fun? Oh, he was just so funny. Yeah. Like, you would never look at him and go, God, he suffers from depression. He was total opposite.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people that are suffering from depression will put up that mask and they will kind of hide it and, you know, they'll be going around smiling, but inside they feel like they're
literally dying. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Mary, thank you for sharing that with us today and highlighting it. And if it helps one person out there or one parent or one psychologist that might be listening, and your message is when a parent comes in with a child and says that you fear for his life or you fear for his safety, that he might take his life, please believe them.
Yeah.
They know.
And that the government give more funding to help more people.
Yeah. All right, Mary, listen, thank you very much indeed. And I appreciate it. All right. Okay, we're all thinking of Ben now. All right. Thanks. Okay. Let me just go to, if I can, Emma, you're on Ireland's Classic Kids. How are you doing, Emma?
Hi, Niall. How are you?
Good. You believe the system has failed many people. And when we listened to how it failed Mary there, certainly the system wasn't there for her. They didn't believe her, unfortunately. It was too late and he took his own life, poor Ben, at 18 years of age. But why do you believe it's failing so many?
Because we go for help and we're told to go home that we're fine.
Yeah.
When we're sitting in front of them and we're begging them that we don't want to live anymore, we have so many thoughts going through our head that we'd just be better off alone and just gone, and that people will get over it eventually, we're told, go home, you will be fine.
That's not the answer, sure it's not, go home.
It's not, no. That's what they taught me on many occasions, was to go home, even though I told them I had my funeral plans written on a book at home.
My gosh, you must have been really struggling at the time.
I was really struggling, really, really struggling.
And when they told you to go home, how did that make you feel then? I mean, you must have felt like they're not believing me. It's a bit surreal, isn't it, almost?
It is, because you're literally on your hands and knees in front of someone who is supposed to try and help you some bit or try and calm you down or bring you back some bit from that dark place that you can see some type of reason to live.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just completely disregarding you.
Yeah.
And like it's heartbreaking to go through it. And then, like, I'm living with my parents, and I was living with my parents at the time, and I'm coming home to them more upset than what I went in. And they're awake at night. They can't sleep because they're worried sick about you. I was going to do something.
Yeah.
It's not nice. Just the way things are in this country, it's not right.
No.
There's too many lost to suicide.
There is, for such a small country. And when we have a small country, you can imagine we can manage things better. You know, I mean, look, when it came to COVID, and I don't want to keep going on about it, but we could pull out all the stops. We can spend as much money as necessary, you know, to save lives, because that's the purpose of it, saving lives. So we can do all that. So if we can do that for a physical illness or a virus or whatever it might happen to be, surely we can do it for mental health, because mental health is a virus too.
It is. And just because people can't see it, that, like, you'd be walking down the road, like, I would go for walks just to clear my head. But you'd never think, when you see me walking down the road, that what I'm thinking in my own head was, at the time, suicidal thoughts. And that my head was racing, and I just wanted to be at peace. That's what I kept on telling people. I wanted to be at peace.
And you figured at that time the only way to do that was not to be here anymore.
Yeah.
And I'm glad, by the way, I'm glad you have had a change of heart. And I'm glad that, you know, things are probably a little bit better for you now. Although I know, you know, once you've had depression or when you've been down that road, it's very easy to slip back into that mode again.
It is. And you have to build yourself up. And then I have an 8-year-old daughter who we sadly lost her dad to suicide 7 years ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
And it was after he passed and I was getting the blame for it. And I knew I had to be there for her.
Yeah.
Because she didn't understand why her dad was gone.
And without her, you probably wouldn't be alive today.
No, I wouldn't. Yeah. I wouldn't.
Yeah.
Because I hug her at night time, even though I've been doing a lot better. And I found my own way with dealing with things.
Yeah.
I still hug her every night. And I actually thank myself that I'm here for her.
Yeah, and she needs you.
She does. She needs me more than anything in the world.
Of course she does. Of course she does.
And that is why I'm here for her. And even the time the ambulance was at my house to take me to hospital due to self-harm only last year, even when the ambulance were coming down, I begged them to be quiet, not to wake her. Because I did not want her to wake and see two paramedics in the house and...
her mother being taken away.
Yeah. That would have scarred her life.
And what was the turning point then for you? Because I know you're now part of a suicide watch in Limerick and where you're trying to help other people as well, which is commendable. But what was the turning point for you, apart from obviously your daughter, that you knew you need to be there for her? What was the turning point? Did you get some sort of help in the end?
Well, I had to travel 2 hours every Friday evening for counselling. From Limerick, I had to travel up the country near Dublin for counselling because I couldn't get anything in Limerick at all.
Oh, gosh.
I used to pay €70 a session, which I never minded paying for it because I was like, it's going to help me. But even during the counselling sessions was the time I was self-harming as well.
But here's the thing, right? I know you didn't mind paying it, right? And you obviously had it at the time to pay. And, well, nobody has €70 to be honest, which you'd rather not be paying it. But in saying that, you'd pay it, you know, because you were concerned about yourself and you're concerned about your well-being. But if you had a physical illness that was life-threatening, you wouldn't have to pay for it. It would be available on the public, you know, on public health. So why should you have to pay for it? You shouldn't have to pick up. You shouldn't have to travel to Dublin either or close to Dublin to get that service. You should be able to get it in Limerick.
Yeah, but there is...
third biggest city in the country, for God's sake.
Yeah, and then Limerick has the highest suicide rate in Ireland.
And why do you think that is, by the way?
The thing, and that's the reason why the...
unemployment, maybe?
...in Limerick is... if the river is there, the river is wide open.
Yeah, well, we've heard so many stories about the river and what has happened there, many people...
Yeah, and I was at the river myself to take my life.
Mm-hmm.
And, like... in a sense, or it might be the wrong thing to say, but because that river is so open, it's like, it's the easiest place to go to.
Yeah.
It is the easiest place to go to. And that's why the patrols are there, and that's why there are people who don't spend as much time with their own family, because they're out there trying to help others.
And that's what you do now as well.
Well, I haven't done it in a while, so I'm trying to... Joan, you're looking after your own mental health.
Of course, yeah, of course. Well, look, your own is priority, absolutely. And then if you have time to help others, well and good.
You have to take a step back and you have to look after yourself as well as much as trying to help others. That's the one thing I had learned to do, because I used to be so wrapped up in mental health awareness and suicide awareness and doing talks and doing videos that I didn't have time to sit back and think what it was actually doing to me as well. And I'm no use to helping other people if I can't help myself.
And do you think the counselling helped you?
It did. I felt he understood me.
Okay.
He wasn't judging me. He wasn't going, oh, this one is still rambling on. He listened to everything.
You felt he actually cared?
Yeah. Where some of them, you can tell they're sitting there and they're just kind of going, is this 40 minutes up yet?
Oh, right. Okay.
You can tell.
Well, you'll always know. If they're watching the time and watching the clock, you know you're with the wrong person.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah. And I've heard from that from people where they've gone to a counsellor and they're literally watching the clock.
Yeah.
And then you know you're with the wrong counsellor.
There was one thing that I said on Facebook last night, and I don't think many people realise it, but Sinead O'Connor's son.
That's right, yeah.
I shared this post about cans, and I had said the harsh reality of it is that people don't look for help because they know they're going to be failed. More than likely, 90% of the time, they're going to be failed.
Or they'll be put on a waiting list for 12 months or something like that. Oh, we'll get you an appointment in 12 months.
Yeah.
And by the way, our condolences, of course, to Sinead O'Connor and her son, Shane, who sadly took his life. Yeah. Look, it is shocking, and unfortunately it doesn't seem to be getting any better, although there's a suggestion now that we should be spending more money on it, but there's no point in having a load of money if you don't know what to be doing with it. We've the same problem with the health service for the last 30 years. It's not money is not the issue. Money has never been the issue in the health service in this country. The issue is administration, and it's getting the people to actually help others. In other words, employing the right people, employing the right amount of people, and finding the people that will take the jobs to help other people. And that's what we need to do.
And
set up the services.
Getting people to... like, it's easy for people to go study for years on psychology and mental health and suicide. But until it's not until you've actually gone through it, you don't know what's going on inside the other person's head. Because you're reading it from a book. Like, I've studied psychology myself. And I'm understanding it a lot more because I'm going, okay, that makes sense. And but if it's someone who has no idea what's going on inside a head, or as I call it, a healthy mind, you don't know what it's like to have the thoughts racing, your head constantly racing, you're trying to do a task and you just can't do it.
Yeah. No, I've, you know what? I've been there. I went through a marriage breakup 4 years ago, and, you know, I've spoken very publicly about the fact that I stood on top of Howth Head and was going to end it at one point at 4 o'clock in the morning. If it wasn't for a phone call, I probably would have. But so I know what it's like for those thoughts to completely cloud your judgment on everything that you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a terrible, it's a very difficult place to be. And it takes a lot of work to get back out of that place again.
And it's scary how we can just, how things like that can just take over your brain.
What's your daughter's name?
Kellyanne is her name.
Kellyanne. Well, Kellyanne is the reason you're talking to me today. And Kellyanne needs you. And that's the most important thing in your life. And should always be. And that's the reason why you should want to obviously live forever.
Yeah, I want to be there for her.
Absolutely.
Because I'm the only parent that she has, and I have to be strong.
You have to be.
Have to do it.
It's been nice talking to you. And good luck in the future, all right? And good luck with Kellyanne in the future. And give her a big hug. Are you there now? Are you at home now, yeah?
Well, she's not finished skills with tree, but I'll give her a big hug then.
Okay, give her a big hug. All right. Okay, listen, thanks very much indeed. And I appreciate you coming on the air to talk to us, all right?
Thanks, Niall.
Okay, we've got to go to a quick break. I'm going to come to Richard straight after the break, by the way. And the number is 087-188-0008. That's 087-188-0008. We're talking about mental health. And do we have enough services in Ireland? Well, certainly we don't. That's a stupid question, by the way. But how do we improve those services? You don't forget, by the way, those numbers again. If you are obviously affected by anything we're talking about today, you can call the Samaritans on 116123 or Pieta House if you want to on 1-800-247-247. My gosh, I see the amount of texts and WhatsApps coming in at the moment in relation to mental health. It's equally as bad as physical health. Absolutely, but just not getting the same recognition. Richard, you're an Ireland's Classic Kids. How you doing, Richard?
How are you, Niall? And this one thing just before I start, I'm sorry to hear of your own pain 4 years ago, and thank God you're still around,
because
your talks are very good, you know?
Thanks, I appreciate that. Now,
no problem. You
suffer from schizophrenia.
Yeah, unfortunately I do, and Ruth, your very nice telephone worker, said to me that, are you still on medication? Unfortunately, we have to take it for life. But
okay.
You see,
for people who don't know, by the way, schizophrenia, you don't hear about schizophrenia very much anymore. Now, of course, with schizophrenia, you can have delusions, you can have hallucinations, disorganized thinking, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So how does it affect you or manifest itself with you if you don't take your medication, for example?
Well, you see, I'll tell you from the start, I was in college and I was doing business studies and stand-up comedy and all, and having the crack. And suddenly I began to fall apart, got depressed, found nothing funny, couldn't concentrate, noticed myself slipping in my own little world. Remembered I was in college in second year. I said, I'm going on a J-1 to America. Pull out of it. What's wrong with you? Be happy like everybody else. But it's a brain disease. And the way it affects me, if I don't take my medication, I can get away with it for 2 or 3 days, but I won't do that. But I did do it once or twice in the past because the drugs are so tiring. I asked the doctor to have a couple of days off. But the way it affects me is you start to hear the grass run. You become uneasy in the street after about 3 days. If somebody's on a bus and they're having a crack, I know that logically they're not laughing at me. But
you become delusional and paranoid and think they are laughing at you.
Yeah, now it would take a week or two for me to become like that.
Yeah.
I could get away with it for a few days because I've taken my meds every day for 34 years, barred a couple of days off.
Right.
You know, literally about three.
And do the meds keep it away?
Oh, they do. Well, they do. Yeah, I mean,
but they have their downside that they make you feel a bit lethargic.
They tire the daylight out of you. They tire the daylight.
Yeah, okay.
They tire you. And the thing is, there's all the psychiatric services focus on is medication. There's no counselling, cheap counselling. We're living on 190 quid a week. There's no cheap counselling for us.
This was highlighted, was it the year before last, a journalist from the Irish Examiner, I think it was, went around to like 16 GPs pretending she had depression, right?
Yeah.
Because it's easy to pretend you have depression. So
yeah,
she pretended.
Yeah.
And every single one of them offered antidepressants. Nobody was offering her talk therapy. You know what I mean? Nobody was recommending she go and see a counsellor. Nobody was recommending, you know, go and see a psychiatrist or talk to the right type of people.
No.
It was just, here's some drugs, see you now.
I think the problem is that sometimes they haven't the time, but they should have allocated services outlaid to council people. Now, we had a social care worker, and he was quite good up in Stillorgan, but he's overworked, and he always says it's important to meet to talk. But I suppose the whole thing is that it's not a vocation, which it should be to these people, because it's okay. The system is okay when you're in and you're sick and you're coming out. But once you're out, you're on a disability allowance and you do or die in the street with job or any chance. Luckily, I came from a family. We're not loaded, but we have a few, Bob. My mum died this year, but she left me the house and a small inheritance. I'm very lucky. I campaign as much as I can. This is my 44th radio interview. I've been on with everybody except RTE. I've been on with... RTE are the only clowns who won't put me. I shouldn't say that. I say it anyway.
But you're becoming a bit of a dab hand at it, Richard, at this stage.
Yeah, I am. It doesn't make me nervous anymore. But the thing is, to make a few points...
Okay, but very quickly, because I've only used a amount of time, but Richard, how do you think we can improve the services? Now, thankfully, you're on your meds, and I personally, it would be better if you weren't on meds and if you could get therapy where you didn't have to be on the meds all the time, all right? But or if we could improve those meds to take away that lethargic feeling that you keep getting all the time. But how can we improve mental health services, generally speaking, so people like you at the early stages, you know, if you go back to when you were a young fella, when this happened first, how do we improve those services to get people in and seen to quicker?
Yeah, well, you need more counselling, first of all, to be taken more seriously by a doctor and given at least 15 minutes for the services and people in power to campaign to get people some kind of structure to their week, purpose, because a lot of us have no purpose. And that's the reason there have been 28 suicides in South County Dublin in the last 15 years. No purpose. A lot of people who were on their meds and have recovered from the illness as well as can be and would be able to work one or two days a week to give society... Let society know that we're not mad. Only hebephrenics are violent. That's a different form of the illness. Schizophrenic people are not violent and dangerous. They only.
Yeah, because as soon as we hear the word schizophrenia, we start thinking of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yes, of course. And of course, the thing is, if you get somebody with schizophrenia who takes street drugs, then they are mad.
Yeah.
And they are crack cocaine. Well, do you know, Niall, people out there who are taking drugs are madder than us. We take our meds and we can't afford to go near street drugs and we wouldn't dare.
Yeah.
But to get the society to listen more, to drop the stigma and the fear. Now, there'll always be stigma. It's like anything. There'll always be stigma. You'll have someone who said, I had a bad experience with somebody with schizophrenia. I'll never trust them again. But 95% of us are more.
And how many people, by the way, just do you know the stats? How many people suffer from schizophrenia in Ireland?
About 20,000.
My gosh.
Maybe a bit more. Yeah. It's 1 in 100, but it's less than that. It's including people who were diagnosed and who've recovered and those in treatment, about 20,000.
My gosh, Richard, I have to say that's a huge amount of people. I didn't think it was that bad. But look, you've said a lot today, Richard, and I hope people are listening. And it's to improve everything, I suppose, is what we're trying to do today. Richard, I appreciate your call and thank you very much.
Yeah, you're very good. Thanks a million, Niall.
All right, see you. I want to go to Emma as well before we finish today. Emma, you're an Ireland's Classic Kids. Now, Emma, I remember speaking to you over a year ago. I think it was kind of November, was it?
Yeah.
And your daughter has OCD.
Anxiety as well, yeah.
And I know that you spoke to us since because you got great help after speaking to us.
Even my friends would be saying it, like, you know, and yeah, Niall Boylan show helped her so much. And I'm like, they helped. You guys got me contact information. And through you guys, I got her private. I had no choice, Niall. I couldn't wait for CAM.
Okay. Yeah.
I did 3 months private. Now, my parents paid. I couldn't afford it.
I remember you telling me that the last time you ran. Yeah.
But we did get her into CAMHS, and she went in March, and she was discharged in September.
Okay.
Just this year. And we weaned her off her meds. That was just, it's Prozac, very mild, very mild.
Yeah.
And 3 weeks after, she had a relapse in terms of, we were back, we did 9 full weeks of no sleep.
To remind people, of course, she has OCD and, you know, her OCD to the extreme.
Yeah.
Literally, you can't go near her sometimes.
No, she was stripping naked to go to the loo in case Anton touches off her. She was wearing socks to bed on her hands because in case her hands touched Anton in the night and then spread it throughout the room. So we did. I contacted CAMHS after 5 weeks of no sleep and they said, try another 2 weeks, you know,
okay,
this is normal. And I was like, yeah, that's fine for you guys. You know, I'm
dealing with
it.
I'm on the cold face here. Yeah.
I have to go into work every day, you know, after all of this all night. But I did it, contacted them. And after 9 weeks, they agreed to put her back on the meds and bring her back in January.
Yeah, because I'd be hoping you wouldn't have to go back on a list because she'd been discharged.
Yeah, I don't know, Niall. It was a struggle for it to get. It was a 3 weeks calling to get through to them.
Yeah.
someone to ring me back.
Oh, I know, I know. Everybody, and by the way, I'm not blaming the staff in CAMHS.
No,
it's the services. They're under-resourced. They're completely under-resourced.
I found them great. I know of people who didn't, but I personally found them
great. Everybody's had a different experience.
Yeah, just can't get through to them. And I'm still waiting now, and I'm in a panic mode because I only got 1 month's supply of her meds because it was Christmas.
So how is she right now?
On the meds, we're like a different child. Her anxiety is there. You'll see her jumping and hopping at little things. Did the dog stand on something outside? Or, you know, little things, I'll see her jump. But she doesn't go into that 900 mode.
Oh, she's like, an obsessive germaphobe.
With the meds, it just means that she goes from 0 to 10 instead of 0 to
100. By the way, I don't know whether I asked this the last time. Has COVID made it worse for her? Because, of course, she's seen it all over the news. The whole world is turning into germaphobes.
To be honest with
you. Has it made it worse?
Yeah, it did. Like, it didn't start until COVID hit. Like, COVID hit in the March, and she started in the August with the whole return to school. They'll have to do this. They'll have to do that.
Oh, you think that was the trigger for it?
Yeah, but I think it was more of that was the straw that broke the camel's back, if that makes sense, after the divorce and everything, you know, over the years. I think that was just the final thing for her. Like, she would have always got this, Niall.
And she's, just for people who didn't know, she's just 11, isn't she?
She's 11 in February now, so it started when she was 9.
Yeah.
So, but she will be like this forever. It's just about coping.
Well, my next question was, did CAMHS or anybody professional say to you that she'll be like that forever, or did they say there's a possibility she may grow out of it?
No. Oh, they told me she will have this for the rest of her life, and it's just about how she manages it. Every single time she has like an attack, I call it, but that's not really the right word for
no,
it.
No, it's not. No, no.
And,
an episode, would that be the right word?
Yeah,
I don't know.
An episode. Yeah. But she does, like, she does try her best, and you can see her, but she just struggles. She cannot sleep with it. It really affects her in the nighttime when she's lying there. And we're sitting in the room, sitting in the landing, you name it, in the bed with her. And even when you're in the bed with her, she's jumping and flipping in her sleep, you know, with the anxiety.
She's probably dreaming about these things as well. You know, you just don't know what's going on in her head.
It's just to cope. And right now, Niall, like, no more than any parent, I don't want my child on meds, but right now they are helping her and they are keeping her on track.
Yeah.
And so I am happy to have her on them, you know?
All right. Well, look, I unfortunately, everyone out of time, Emma, but
no, I understand.
It's lovely, lovely talking to you again.
Yeah, you're a great help. And you always bring this up. It's fantastic.
All right. It's been lovely talking to you, Emma. Have a great day, a great weekend, and look after your daughter. All right. Thanks very much indeed.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Real people, real opinions, real talk radio. The multi-award-winning Niall Boylan Show. Classic hit.